Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Small Wonder, and obviously a particularly warm welcome to Ali Smith. Before I say anything about Ali, I just want to say something about the background hum. For those of you who haven't already guessed or haven't already been told, that's the milking machine. It can this noise level can sometimes be a bit uneven. We hope it won't be too distracting, and we particularly hope it won't be too distracting for Ali. We feel it adds to the atmosphere.
I'm just going to go home because I can't concentrate.
So very quickly then, before we have, there's a chance for Ali to go home while she's still here, just to tell you a little bit about Ali. Ali is one of our most original and playful writers of fiction, novels as well as short stories. According to Alain de Botton, Alan is a genius, genuinely modern, in the heroic, glorious sense. And the observer, delicious, funny, sexy, poignant. Hey. Smith's nice. Novels fizz with pyrotechnic prose, whirlwind openings, bewitching invention. She's been shortlisted twice for the Booker and Orange Prizes and won the Whitbread Novel of the Year for The Accidental. Her novels also include Hotel World and the most recent, very, very recent, There But For The. I haven't missed out a word. And she has published several short story collections. In a review of There But For The in The Independent, the reviewer said of Ali's writing, "There are moments when the book stops me in my tracks with its glittering imagination. Moments when I really do laugh out loud. And penny-dropping moments when I turn a page and my eyes fill up." Ali is also renowned for telling stories within stories. This afternoon, she's taking a break from her own writing. She's having a little holiday, and she's reading some stories by a writer that I guessed, and it was confirmed, she confirmed, that she feels a particular affinity with, Muriel Spock. And I'll leave Ali to tell you all about that. Now, Ali is going to read a Muriel Spock story. She'll then talk a little bit about, her feelings and her interest in Muriel Spock. And then she'll end with another Muriel Spock story. And there'll still be time for some questions from the audience. Ali.
Thank you. Hello. Can you hear me okay? Okay. Can I ask the lighting person to turn the lights up slightly on the audience? Just so that we're all here. So I can see if any of you fall asleep. I won't wake you, I'd just like to know if any of you will fall asleep. No, you won't fall asleep, because I'm going to read from Spark, from Muriel Spark. I'm going to read a story that's new to me. I reread all her stories to do this event, and read one I hadn't read before that I absolutely loved. And I'm going to read that one first, and then I'm going to maunder on for about 10 minutes about things that came to mind when I was reading through all these stories, and then I'm going to read you another fantastic Muriel Spark story. So, 1952, this story was written. The Leaf Sweeper. Behind the town hall, there is a wooded parkland which, towards the end of November, begins to draw a thin blue cloud right into itself. And as a rule, the park floats in this haze until mid-February. I pass every day and see Johnny Geddes in the heart of this mist, sweeping up the leaves. Now and again he stops and, jerking his long head erect, looks indignantly at the pile of leaves as if it ought not to be there. Then he sweeps on. This business of leaf sweeping he learned during the years he spent in the asylum. It was the job they always gave him to do, and when he was discharged, the town council gave him the leaves to sweep. But the indignant movement of his head comes naturally to him, for this has been one of his habits since he was the most promising and buoyant and vociferous graduate of his year. He looks much older than he is, for it's not quite 20 years ago that Johnny founded the Society for the Abolition of Christmas. Johnny was living with his aunt then. I was at school, and in the Christmas holidays, Miss Geddes gave me her nephew's pamphlet, How to Grow Rich at Christmas. sounded very likely, but it turned out that you grow rich at Christmas by doing away with Christmas. And so pondered Johnny's pamphlet no further. But it was only his first attempt he had within the next 3 years founded his Society of Abolitionists. His new book, Abolish Christmas or We Die, was in great demand at the public library, and my turn for it came at last. Johnny was really convincing this time, and most people were completely won over until after they had closed the book. I got an old copy for sixpence the other day, and despite the lapse of time, it still proves conclusively that Christmas is a national crime. Johnny demonstrates that every human unit in the kingdom faces inevitable starvation within a period inversely proportional to that in which one in every six industrial productivity units, if you see what he means, stop producing toys to fill the stockings of the educational intake units. He cites appalling statistics to show that 1.024% of the time squandered each Christmas in reckless shopping and thoughtless church going brings the nation closer to its doom by 5 years. A few readers protested, but Johnny was able to demolish their muddled arguments, and meanwhile the Society for the Abolition of Christmas increased. But Johnny was troubled. Not only did Christmas rage throughout the kingdom as usual that year, but he had private information that many of the Society members had broken the oath of abstention. He decided then to strike at the very roots of Christmas. Johnny gave up his job on the drainage supply board. He gave up all his prospects and, financed by a few supporters, retreated for 2 years to study the roots of Christmas. Then, all jubilant, Johnny produced his next and last book, in which he established either that Christmas was an invention of the early fathers to propitiate the pagans, or it was invented by the pagans to placate the early fathers, I forget which. Against the advice of his friends, Johnny entitled it Christmas and Christianity. It sold 18 copies. Johnny never really recovered from this, and it happened about that time that the girl he was engaged to, an ardent abolitionist, sent him a pullover she had knitted for Christmas. He sent it back, enclosing a copy of the Society's rules, and she sent back the ring. But in any case, during Johnny's absence, the Society had been undermined by a moderate faction. These moderates finally became more moderate, and the whole thing broke up. Soon after this, I left the district, and it was some years before I saw Johnny again. One Sunday afternoon in summer, I was idling among the crowds who were gathered to hear the speakers at Hyde Park. One little crowd surrounded a man who bore a banner marked Crusade Against Christmas. His voice was frightening. It carried an unusually long way. This was Johnny. A man in the crowd told me Johnny was there every Sunday, very violent about Christmas, and that he would soon be taken up for insulting language. As I saw in the papers, he was soon taken up for insulting language. And a few months later, I heard that poor Johnny was in a mental home because he had Christmas on the brain and couldn't stop shouting about it. After that, I forgot all about him until 3 years ago in December, I went to live near the town where Johnny had spent his youth. On the afternoon of Christmas Eve, I was walking with a friend, noticing what had changed in my absence and what hadn't. We passed a long, large house once famous for its armoury, and I saw that the iron gates were wide open. Ah, they used to be kept shut, I said. Oh, that's an asylum now, said my friend. They let the mild cases work in the grounds and leave the gates open to give them a feeling of freedom. But, said my friend, they lock everything inside, door after door, the lift as well, they keep it locked. While my friend was chattering, I stood in the gateway and looked in. Just beyond the gate was a great bare elm tree. There I saw a man in brown corduroys sweeping up the leaves. Poor soul, he was shouting about Christmas. That's Johnny Geddes, I said. Has he been here all these years? Yes, said my friend as we walked on. I believe he gets worse at this time of the year. Does his aunt see him? Yes, and she sees nobody else. We were, in fact, approaching the house where Miss Geddes lived. I suggested we call on her. I had known her well. No fear, said my friend. I decided to go in all the same, and my friend walked on to the town. Miss Geddes had changed more than the landscape. She had been a solemn, calm woman, and now she moved about quickly and gave short, agitated smiles. She took me to her sitting room, and as she opened the door, she called to someone inside. Johnny, see who's come to see us. A man dressed in a dark suit was standing on a chair, fixing holly behind a picture. He jumped down. Happy Christmas, he said. A happy and a merry Christmas indeed. I do hope, he said, you're going to stay for tea, as we've got a delightful Christmas cake, and at this season of goodwill, I would be cheered indeed if you could see how charmingly it's decorated. It has Happy Christmas in red icing, and then there's a robin, and... Johnny, said Miss Geddes, you're forgetting the carols. The carols, he said. He lifted a gramophone record from a pile and put it on. It was The Holly and the Ivy. It's The Holly and the Ivy, said Miss Geddes. Can't we have something else? We've had that all morning. It is sublime, he said, beaming from his chair and holding up his hand for silence. While Miss Geddes went to fetch the tea and he sat absorbed in his carol, I watched him. He was so like Johnny that if I hadn't seen poor Johnny a few moments before sweeping up the asylum leaves, I would have thought he really was Johnny. Miss Geddes returned with the tray, and while he rose to put on another record, he said something that startled me. "I saw you in the crowd that Sunday when I was speaking at Hyde Park." "What a memory you have," said Miss Geddes. "Must be 10 years ago," he said. "My nephew has altered his opinion of Christmas," she explained. "He always comes home for Christmas now, and don't we have a jolly time, Johnny?" "Rather," I said. "Oh, let me cut the cake." He was very excited about the cake. With a flourish, he dug a large knife into the side. The knife slipped, and I saw it run deep into his finger. Miss Geddes did not move. He wrenched his cut finger away and went on slicing the cake. "Isn't it bleeding?" I said. He held up his hand. I could see the deep cut, but there was no blood. Deliberately and perhaps desperately, I turned to Miss Geddes. "That house up the road," I said. "I see it's a mental home now. I passed it this afternoon." "Johnny," said Miss Geddes, as one who knows the game is up, "go and fetch the mince pies." He went, whistling a carol. "You passed the asylum," said Miss Geddes wearily. "Yes," I said, "and you saw Johnny sweeping up the leaves." "Yes." We could still hear the whistling of the carol. "Who's he?" I said. "That's Johnny's ghost," she said. "He comes home every Christmas. But," she said, "I don't like him. I can't bear him any longer, and I'm going away tomorrow. I don't want Johnny's ghost. I want Johnny in flesh and blood." I shuddered, thinking of the cut finger that could not bleed. And I left before Johnny's ghost returned with the mince pies. Next day, as I'd arranged to join a family who lived in the town, I started walking over about noon. Because of the light mist, I didn't see at first who it was approaching. It was a man waving his arm to me. It turned out to be Johnny's ghost. "Happy Christmas! What do you think?" said Johnny's ghost. "My aunt has gone to London fancy on Christmas Day, and I thought she was at church, and here I am, without anyone to spend a jolly Christmas with, and of course I forgive her, as it's the season of goodwill, but I'm glad to see you, because now I can come with you, wherever it is you're going, and we can all have a happy..." "Go away," I said, and walked on. It sounds hard, but perhaps you don't know how repulsive and loathsome is the ghost of a living man. The ghosts of the dead may be all right, but the ghost of Mad Johnny gave me the creeps. "Clear off," I said. He continued walking beside me. "As it's the time of goodwill, I make allowances for your tone," he said, "but I'm coming." We had reached the asylum gates, and there in the grounds I saw Johnny sweeping up the leaves. I suppose it was his way of going on strike, working on Christmas Day. He was making a noise about Christmas. On a sudden impulse, I said to Johnny's ghost, "You want company?" "Certainly," he replied. "It's the season of..." "Then you shall have it," I said. I stood in the gateway. "Oh, Johnny," I called. He looked up. "I've brought your ghost to see you, Johnny." "Well, well," said Johnny, advancing to meet his ghost. "Just imagine it." "Happy Christmas," said Johnny's ghost. "Oh, really?" said Johnny. I left them to it, and when I looked back, wondering if they would come to blows, I saw that Johnny's ghost was sweeping the leaves as well. They seemed to be arguing at the same time, but it was still misty, and really I can't say whether, when I looked a second time, there were two men or one man sweeping the leaves. Johnny began to improve in the new year. At least he stopped shouting about Christmas, and then he never mentioned it at all. In a few months, when he'd almost stopped saying anything, they discharged him. The town council gave him the leaves of the park to sweep. He seldom speaks and recognises nobody. I see him every day at the late end of the year, working within the mist. Sometimes, if there's a sudden gust, he jerks his head up to watch a few leaves falling behind him, as if amazed that they are undeniably there, although, by rights, the falling of leaves should be stopped. There's that one. Oh, Spark, such a glorious kind of metaphor for the things about which we're completely helpless, which will kind of split our spirits and ourselves. Here's a great quote from a 1980 story she wrote called The Fortune Teller. The character says, and you can apply this back to Spark, "You mustn't think that because I take my gifts seriously, I take them solemnly. It's all an airy dream of mine, unsinkable, because it's light." I mean, usually she's thought of as the kind of... There's a bit of Jean Brodie and a bit of the repressions, the Scottish repressions that she ironises in Jean Brodie, that pass in some way in people's versions of Spark as a writer. The ideas of nothing wasted, economy, precision. But, you know, at the same time as being the most precise of writers, she makes fun of the people of spareness, the people of neatness, the prim and the repressed, while her own spareness in her prose produces I was going to say untold richness, but actually it's told richness. We're told, we're shown, we're given richness, resonance. She's the opposite and the inheritor of the stern and wild. Her sternness is, her wildness is full of hilarity, I think. There's a visionary quality in her that people tend to forget about, that's kind of drenched in romantic poetry and the Gothic of Coleridge, Scott's balladry. There's a visionary shrewdness, if that's possible, a uniting of these opposites in the same thing. She's very much, when you read her, about how to read things, how we go about reading things. Oh, I see, the heroine of The Go Away Bird keeps saying, it's her refrain. Oh, I see. And of course, the understanding and the seeing are the same things, the reading of signs. But, you know, at the heart of Spark, and this is what this collection really revealed to me and reminded me about her novels too, there's a deep interest in violence and the matter-of-factness of violence, that the kind of post-war nature of her writing and her time that she spent. She worked in intelligence in the war. She went to ask, could she help out with the war, and she was carrying an Ivy Compton Burnett book. And she sat down and spoke to a lady. She said, can I help with the war effort? And the lady looked at the book and said, do you like that novel? And Spark said, yes, I think it's wonderful. And then they chatted for 10 minutes about Ivy Compton Burnett. And then the woman went, and she opened a drawer and she said, I think I have something very interesting for you. And passed her on to intelligence. I know. So the time of being intelligent, she came out of it and she had kind of shaken to such an extent by the war, as most people were, but she came out of it into a breakdown and then into a Roman Catholic conversion in the decade after. And these stories kind of reveal the way she analyses the neuroses, the numbness of this post-war state, and herself advocates wryness or wit, a state of wry acceptance or objectivity, always underscored by an absurdity which is sometimes Scottish and sometimes Roman Catholic, which again are two opposites which, if you put them in the same room, you have to hold them like this, you know, to keep them in the same place. But it's a blessed state of otherness or difference or possibility. The lady on the front is really laughing. She knows exactly what I mean. There's something mercenary and pure about her merriment. There's a kind of mercilessness in it, which is a kind of mercy in itself, the kind I associate with Chekhov or Mansfield. Because all Spark's fiction has this distilled quality of short fiction, the exactness of inquiry into class and place and pressure, a brilliant puncturer of snobberies, a holder in the one hand of inference and innocence, or to take one of her later titles from one of her novels, Reality and Dream. So reality and the dream state are the same thing in so much of her work, as at the same time as madness and sanity are the same thing in so much of her work. She has this extraordinary vision of the strange up against the mundane, and this huge and stately kind of surrealness up against the page. She reminds me of Leonora Carrington, writers like Carrington. High surreality, but one that always holds its teacup properly. And this will be, again, I'm remembering an autobiographical piece she wrote called What Images Return, where she's in Edinburgh. She's kind of waiting for her father to die, and because he's dying, and she's in a hotel. She looks out and she sees the castle in Edinburgh floating on its great rock, and she sees the float and the rock. And she thinks Edinburgh is a kind of giver of what she calls the nevertheless principle. She imagines these ladies in Morningside sitting going, aye, well, they said the weather would be fine. Nevertheless, it's raining. She thinks that that's a particularly Scottish gift, and I think she's, you know, she might be right about that. Very interested in anarchy and wisdom, especially of the old, another link with Leonora Carrington, I think, there. And, she's also fantastic with cliché. There's a story in here called The Portobello Road, which takes the phrase needle in a haystack and then makes a whole murder mystery around someone called Needle, who is murdered in a haystack. There's at one point, there's a, in that story, Needle is talking to the man who's going to murder her later, and he's saying to her, oh, got to understand my situation, I needed the woman. And Needle looks at him and she says, I was nearly sick. One, because of my Scottish upbringing, and two, because of my horror of corny phrases like, I needed the woman. And that's exactly it. She pulls you up short with when it comes to cliché all the time. She's always making you re-examine not just language, but the ways that language works as performance, and the ways that gender and sexuality and culture work as kind of charade or mad performance. Now, the experience of reading this book, which is introduced by Janice Galloway, who, with any luck, you all were here listening to just in the last hour, Muriel Spark, The Complete Short Stories, introduced beautifully by Janice. She's still here. I hope she'll sign some of the books at the end for us. I read through them and they're so funny. I was lying on my bed, kind of, and Sarah would shout up the stairs, what are you doing? And I was getting going, meanwhile, Sarah and I work in a charity bookshop. Sarah, more than me, I work for a couple of hours on a Monday, and last Monday we were in the charity bookshop and I had just read a story where a man goes to see his psychotherapist, and he sits down and the psychotherapist says, now, what's your name? And he says, Mr. O. Nevis. And she says, okay, what's your problem? He says, I'm being followed by a pearly shadow. The pearly shadow, can't you see it? It's there behind you, the pearly shadow. She's like, okay, take some tranquilizers, relax, just sit quietly, relax. She sends him home. She goes out and says to the receptionist, who's next? And the receptionist says, it's Mr. P. Shadow. And she goes in, and Mr. P. Shadow comes in, and he sits down, and you know, like this, and she says, what's the matter? She says, people are always trying to get rid of me. I told Sarah this story, and Sarah became more and more freaked out and began to believe there was a ghost in the shop. That, quite literally, very, very unsettling stories. And their surrealness is like a kind of pure high adrenaline. I mean, I don't know if you've ever read the first story that she ever won a prize for. I don't know if it was the first story that she wrote, but it was a story that made her write all her fiction, really. It was launched, and it was a winner of the Observer Short Story Competition in 1951, I think, The Seraph and the Zambezi, in which, this is how she describes, first she describes a pantomime angel like you see on Christmas nativity plays, and then she describes a real angel who appears and glows so brightly, it's rather like this noise behind us, that the whole place almost threatens to burn down. This is how she describes this angel. This was a living body. The most noticeable thing was its constancy. It seemed not to conform to the law of perspective, but remained the same size when I approached it as when I withdrew. And altogether unlike other forms of life, it had a completed look. No part was undergoing a process. The outline lacked the signs of confusion and ferment, which commonly indicate living things. And this was also the principle of its beauty. The eyes took up nearly the whole of the head, extending far over the cheekbones. From the back of the head came two muscular wings, which from time to time folded themselves over the eyes, making a draft of scorching air. There was hardly any neck. Another pair of wings, tough and supple, spread from below the shoulders, and a third pair extended from the calves to the legs. It's pure surrealism. It's like if we went up the street to Farley Farm and looked at Roland Penrose's collections and his own pictures of by Max Ernst or by Carrington, Leonora Carrington. It's very related to that post-war surrealism. And it's an interestingly kind of good description of the way much of her own artifice would work, strangely winged with this extraordinary eye power, alive and yet somehow complete and indisputable. So many of her stories have got this first-person narrator that it feels like there's a glorious kind of individualism about them at the same time as we're being asked to witness or be part of witness. And then there's this ghost world. For Spark, I think the short story, and I thought this for the first time really reading these this time, it's really a ghost form. I'm beginning to believe anyway that the short story is a form deeply connected and concerned with mortality. With Spark, I think this really holds true. But the thing is, the other thing about this particular collection that really was a glory, actually, when I was reading through it, what happens when you read these stories is that you see her true talent, which is for prose, which is both finished and still spontaneous, as if it's alive as we read it, as if it's thinking for itself on the page, right in front of our eyes, a prose that's actually an intelligence in itself. I mean, these are electrifying stories. They multiply possibilities, and at the same time, they force you to accept something, fate, a destiny, something which you can't. There's a lovely piece at the beginning of The Girls of Slender Means where she says, there'd be no point being depressed about the Second World War. It would be like being depressed about the Grand Canyon. You know, and this is incredibly liberating. Her merriness, her wryness, the state she gets to of objectivity is immensely up against the horrors of the 20th century liberating. I'm just going to check our time. Okay. I'm going to read you now. Well, would you like to choose which one I would read you? Okay. Would you like me to read you? The House of the Famous Poet, or Come Along, Marjorie. Shall I read you the first paragraph of both? And then you can choose. Yeah? Okay. Wait a minute till I find Come Along Marjorie. Unless anyone's got a favourite, shout it out now, quick. There's no ghosts here, none at all. 384, okay, hang on a wee minute. Okay. The beginning of The House of the Famous Poet is, in the summer of 1944, when it was nothing for trains from the provinces to be 5 or 6 hours late, I travelled to London on the night train from Edinburgh, which, at York, was already 3 hours late. There were 10 people in the compartment, only 2 of whom I remember well, and for good reason. Don't be fooled by its mundanity. Okay, this is the beginning of Come Along Marjorie. Not many days had passed since my arrival at Watling Abbey when I realised that most of us were recovering from nerves. The abbey, a 12th century foundation, lies in Worcestershire on the site of an ancient temple of Mithras. It had recently been acquired and restored by its original religious order at that time, just after the war, when I went to stay there and found after a few days that most of us were nervous cases. Which one do you want? First one. Okay, first one. Okay. And then for everybody who wants a second one, we'll do it outside. Okay, The House of the Famous Poet. In the summer of 1944, when it was nothing for trains from the provinces to be 5 or 6 hours late, I travelled to London on the night train from Edinburgh, which, at York, was already 3 hours late. There were 10 people in the compartment, only 2 of whom I remember well, and for good reason. I have the impression, looking back on it, of a row of people opposite me dozing untidily with heads askew, and it often seems when we look at sleeping strangers, their features had assumed extra emphasis and individuality, sometimes disturbing to watch. It was as if they'd rendered up their daytime talent for obliterating the outward traces of themselves in exchange for mental obliteration. In this way, they resembled a 12th century fresco. There was a look of medieval and self-consciousness about these people. All except one. This was a private soldier who was awake to a greater degree than most people are when they're not sleeping. He was smoking cigarettes one after the other with long, calm puffs. I thought he looked excessively evil. An atavistic type. His forehead must have been less than 2 inches high above dark, thick eyebrows, which met. His jaw was not large, but it was ape-like. So it was his small nose, and so were his deep, close-set eyes. I thought there must have been some consanguinity in the appearance. He was quite a throwback. As it turned out, he was extremely gentle and kind. When I ran out of cigarettes, he fished about in his haversack and produced a packet for me and one for a girl sitting next to me. We both tried with a flutter of small change to pay him. Nothing would please him at all but that we should accept his cigarettes, whereupon he returned to his silent, reflective smoking. I felt a sort of pity for him then, rather as we feel towards animals we know to be harmless, such as monkeys. But I realised that, like the pity we expend on monkeys merely because they're not human beings, this pity was not needed. Receiving the cigarettes gave the girl and myself common ground, and we conversed quietly for the rest of the journey. She told me she had a job in London as a domestic helper and nursemaid. She looked as if she'd come from a country district. Her very blonde hair, red face and large bones gave the impression of power, as if she was used to carrying heavy things, perhaps great scuttles of coal or 2 children at a time. But what made me curious about her was her voice, which was cultivated, melodious and restrained. Towards the end of the journey, when the people were beginning to jerk themselves straight and rushing to and fro in the corridor had started, this girl, Elise, asked me to come with her to the house where she worked. The master, who was something in a university, was away with his wife and family. I agreed to this because at the time I was in the way of thinking that the discovery of an educated servant girl was valuable and something to be gone deeper into. It had the element of experience, perhaps even of truth, and I believed in those days that truth is stranger than fiction. Besides, I wanted to spend that Sunday in London. I was due back next day at my job in the branch of the civil service, which had been evacuated to the country, and for a reason that's another story, I didn't want to return too soon. I had some telephoning to do. I wanted to wash and change. I wanted to know more about the girl. So I thanked Elise and accepted her invitation. I regretted it as soon as we got out of the train at King's Cross, some minutes after 10. Standing up tall on the platform, Elise looked unbearably tired, as if not only the last night's journey, but every fragment of her unknown life was suddenly heaping on top of her. The power I'd noticed in the train was no longer there. As she called in her beautiful voice for a porter, I saw that on the side of her head, that had been away from me in the train, her hair was parted in a dark streak, which by contrast with the yellow, looked navy blue. I thought when when I first saw her that possibly her hair was bleached, but now seeing it so badly done, seeing this navy blue parting pointing like an arrow to the weighted weariness of her face, I too got the sensation of great tiredness, and it was not only the strain of the journey that I felt, but the foreknowledge of boredom that comes upon us unaccountably at the beginning of a quest, and that checks, perhaps mercifully, our curiosity. And as it happened, there really wasn't much to learn about Elise. The explanation of her that I had been prompted to seek, I got into the taxi between King's Cross and the house at Swiss Cottage. She came of a good family, who thought her a pity, and she them. Having no training for anything else, she'd taken a domestic job on leaving home. She was engaged to an Australian soldier, billeted also at Swiss Cottage. Perhaps it was the anticipation of a day's boredom. Maybe it was the effect of no sleep or the fact that the V1 sirens were sounding. But I felt some sourness when I saw the house. The garden was growing all over the place. Elise opened the front door and we entered a darkish room almost wholly taken up with a long, plain wooden work table. On this were a half-empty marmalade jar, a pile of papers, and a dried-up ink bottle. There was a steel-canopied bed, known as a Morrison shelter, in one corner, and some photographs on the mantelpiece, one of a schoolboy wearing glasses. Everything was tainted with Elise's weariness and my own distaste, but Elise didn't seem to be aware of the exhaustion so plainly revealed on her face. She did not even bother to take her coat off, and as it was too tight for her, I wondered how she could move about so quickly with this restriction added to the weight of her tiredness. But with her coat still buttoned tight, Elise phoned her boyfriend and made breakfast while I washed in a dim, blue, cracked bathroom upstairs. When I found that she'd opened my holdall without asking me and had taken out all my rations, I was a little pleased. It seemed a friendly action with some measure of reality about it, and I felt better, but I was still irritated by the house. I felt there was no justification for the positive lack of consequence which was lying about here and there. I asked no questions about the owner, who was something in the university, for fear of getting the answer I expected, that he was away visiting his grandchildren at some family gathering in the home counties. The owners of the house had no reality for me, and I looked upon the place as belonging to, and permeated with, Elise. I went with her to a nearby public house, where she met her boyfriend and one or two other Australian soldiers. They had with them a thin Cockney girl with bad teeth. Elise was very happy and insisted in her lovely voice that they should all come along to a party at the house that evening. In a fine aristocratic tone, she demanded that each should bring a bottle of beer. During the afternoon, Elise said she was going to have a bath, and she showed me a room where I could use the telephone and sleep if I wanted. This was a large, light room with several windows, much more orderly than the rest of the house, and lined with books. There was only one unusual thing about it. Beside one of the windows was a bed, but this bed was only a fairly thick mattress made up neatly on the floor. It was obviously a bed on the floor with some purpose. And again, I was angered to think of the futile crankiness of the elderly professor who had thought of it. I did my telephoning and decided to rest, but first I wanted to find something to read. The books puzzled me. None of them seemed to be automatically part of a scholar's library. An inscription in one book was signed by the author, a well-known novelist. I found another inscribed copy, and this had the name of the recipient. On a sudden idea, I went to the desk, where, while I'd been telephoning, I had noticed a pile of unopened letters. For the first time, I looked at the name of the owner of the house. I ran to the bathroom and shouted through the door to Elise, "Is this the house of the famous poet?" "Yes," she called. "I told you." She told me nothing of the kind. I felt I had no right at all to be there, for it wasn't now the house of Elise acting by proxy for some unknown couple. It was the house of a famous modern poet. The thought that at any moment he and his family might walk in and find me there terrified me. I insisted that Elise should open the bathroom door and tell me to my face that there was no possible chance of their returning for many days to come. Then I began to think about the house itself, which Elise was no longer accountable for, and its new definition as the house of a poet whose work I knew well, many of whose poems I knew by heart. This gave it altogether a new appearance. To confirm this, I went outside and stood exactly where I'd been when I first saw the garden from the door of the taxi. I wanted to get my first impression for a second time. And this time, I saw an absolute purpose in the overgrown garden, which since then I have come to believe existed in the eye of the beholder, but at that time the room we had first entered and which had riled me now began to give back a meaning, and whatever was right. The caked-up bottle of ink, which Elise had put on the mantelpiece, I replaced on the table to make sure. I saw a photograph I hadn't noticed before, and I recognised the famous poet. It was the same with the upstairs room where Elise had put me, and I handled the books again, not so much with the sense that they had belonged to the famous poet, but with some curiosity about how they had been made. The sort of question that occurred to me was where the paper had come from, and what sort of vegetation was manufactured the black print, and these things have not troubled me since. The Australians and the Cockney girl came round about 7. I had planned to catch an 8:30 train to the country, but when I telephoned to confirm the time, I found there were no Sunday trains running. Elise, in her friendly and exhausted way, begged me to stay without attempting to be too serious about it. The sirens were starting up again. I asked Elise once more to repeat that the poet and his family could by no means return that night. But I asked this question more abstractedly than before, as I was thinking of the sirens and of the exact proportion of the noise they'd made. I wondered as well what sinister genius of the Home Office could have invented so ominous a wail, and why. And I was thinking of the word siren. The sound then became comical, for I imagined some maniac sea nymph from centuries past belching into the year 1944. Actually, the sirens frightened me. Most of all, I wondered about Elise's party. Everyone roamed about the place as if it were nobody's house in particular, with Elise the best behaved of the lot. The Cockney girl sat in the long table and gave of her best to the skies every time a bomb exploded. I had the feeling that the house had been requisitioned for an evening by the military. It was so hugely and everywhere occupied that it became not the house I had first entered, nor the house of the famous poet, but a third house, the one I'd vaguely prefigured when I stood bored on the platform at King's Cross Station. I saw a great amount of tiredness among those people, and heard from the loud noise they made that they were all lacking sleep. When the beer was finished and they were gone, some to their billets, some to pubs, and the Cockney girl to her underground shelter where she'd slept for weeks past, I asked Elise, "Don't you feel tired?" "No," she said with agonizing weariness, "I never feel tired." I fell asleep myself, as soon as I'd got into the bed on the floor in the upstairs room, and overslept until Elise woke me at 8. I'd wanted to get up early to catch a 9 o'clock train, so I hadn't much time to speak to her. I did notice, though, that she had lost some of her tired look. I was pushing my things into my hold-all while Elise went up the street to catch a taxi when I heard someone coming upstairs. I thought it was Elise come back, and I looked out of the open door. I saw a man in uniform carrying an enormous parcel in both hands. He looked down as he climbed and had a cigarette in his mouth. "Do you want Elise?" I called, thinking it was one of her friends. He looked up, and I recognised the soldier, the throwback, who'd given us cigarettes in the train. "Well, anyone will do," he said. "The thing is..." Ooh. What is that noise? Still a milking machine. Ooh, that was fantastic. It was the siren from 1944 throwing itself into 2011. Okay. Soldier's coming up the stairs with his cigarette. He looked up and I recognised the soldier, the throwback, who'd given us cigarettes in the train. "Well, anyone will do," he says. "The thing is, I've got to get back to camp and I'm stuck for the fare, 8 and 6. I told him I could manage it and was finding the money when he said, putting his parcel on the floor, "I don't want to borrow it. I wouldn't think of borrowing it. I've got something for sale." "What's that?" I said. "A funeral," said the soldier. "I've got it here." This alarmed me, and I went to the window. No hearse, no coffin stood below. I saw only the avenue of trees. The soldier smiled. "It's an abstract funeral," he explained, opening the parcel. He took it out, and I examined it carefully, greatly comforted. It was very much the sort of thing I had wanted, rather more purple in parts than I would have liked, for I was not in favour of this colour of mourning. Still, I thought I could tone it down a bit. Delighted with the bargain, I handed over the 8 shillings and 6p. There was a great deal of this abstract funeral. Hastily, I packed some of it into the hold-all. Some I stuffed into my pockets, and there was still some left over. Elise had returned with a cab, and I hadn't much time, so I ran for it out the door and out of the gate of the house of the famous poet, with the rest of my funeral trailing behind me. You will complain that I am withholding evidence. Indeed, you may wonder if there is any evidence at all. An abstract funeral, you will say, is neither here nor there. It's only a notion. You cannot pack a notion into your bag. You cannot see the colour of a notion. You will insinuate that what I have just told you is pure fiction. Hear me to the end. I caught the train. Imagine my surprise when I found sitting opposite me my friend, the soldier, of whose existence you are so sceptical. "As a matter of interest," I said, "how would you describe all this funeral you sold me?" "Describe it," he said. "Nobody describes an abstract funeral. You just conceive it." There's much in what you say, I replied. Still, describe it I must, because it's not every day one comes by an abstract funeral. I'm glad you appreciate that, said the soldier. And after the war, I continued, when I'm no longer a civil servant, I hope in a few deftly turned phrases to write of my experiences at the house of the famous poet, which has culminated like this. But of course, I added, I'll need to say what it looks like. The soldier did not reply. If it were an okapi or a sea cow, I said, I would have to say what it looked like. No one would believe me otherwise. Do you want your money back? Asked the soldier, because if so, you can't have it. I spent it on my ticket. Don't misunderstand me, I hastened to say. The funeral is a delightful abstraction, only I wish to put it down in writing. I felt a great pity for the soldier on seeing his worried look. The ape-like head seemed the saddest thing in the world. I make them by hand, he said, these abstract funerals. A siren sounded somewhere far away. Elise bought one of them last month. She hadn't any complaints. I change at the next stop, he said, getting down his kit from the rack. And what's more, he said, your famous poet bought one. Oh, did he? I said, yes, he said, no complaints. It was just what he wanted, the idea of a funeral. The train pulled up. The soldier leaped down and waved. As the train started again, I unpacked my abstract funeral and looked at it for a few moments. To hell with the idea, I said. It's a real funeral I want. All in good time, said the voice from the corridor. You again, I said. It was the soldier. No, he said, I got off at the last station. I'm only a notion of myself. Look here, I said, would you be offended if I throw all this away? Of course not, said the soldier. You can't offend a notion. I want a real funeral, I explained, one of my own. That's right, said the soldier. And then I'll be able to write about it and go into all the details, I said. Your own funeral, he said. Do you want to write it up? Yes, I said. But, he said, you're only human. Nobody reports on their own funeral. It's got to be abstract. You see my predicament, I said. I see it, he replied. I get off at this stop. The notion of a soldier alighted. Once more the train put on speed. Out of the window I chucked all my 8 and 6 pence worth of abstract funeral. I watched it fluttering over the fields and around the tops of camouflage factories with the sun glittering richly upon it until it was out of sight. In the summer of 1944, a great many people were harshly and suddenly killed. The papers reported in due course those whose names were known to the public. One of these, the famous poet, had returned unexpectedly to his home at Swiss Cottage a few moments before it was hit directly by a flying bomb. Fortunately, he'd left his wife and children in the country. When I got to the place where my job was, I had some time to spare before going on duty. I decided to ring Elise and thank her properly, as I'd left in such a hurry. But the lines were out of order, and the operator could not find words enough to express her annoyance with me. Behind this overworked, quarrelsome voice from the exchange, I heard the high, long hoot, which means that the telephone at the other end is not functioning, and the sound made me infinitely depressed and weary. It was more intolerable to me than the sirens, and I replaced the receiver, and in fact, Elise had already perished under the house of the famous poet. The blue cracked bathroom, the bed on the floor, the caked ink bottle, the neglected garden, and the neat rows of books. I try to gather them together in my mind whenever I'm enraged by the thought that Elise and the poet were killed outright. The angels of the resurrection will invoke the dead man and the dead woman, but who will care to restore the fallen house of the famous poet, if not myself? Who else will tell its story? When I reflect how Elise and the poet were taken in, how they calmly allowed a well-meaning soldier to sell them the notion of a funeral, I remind myself that one day I will accept, and so will you, an abstract funeral, and make no complaints. Oy, oy, oy. Hello.
Hi there. You talked about the short story form being deeply connected to mortality, and I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
I knew someone would ask me that at this festival. More and more, while I've been working on short stories, I've realised how hard they are to work on and how much work they are. and how, after you've finished a collection of stories, and I also write novels and other forms as well, but stories are particularly, they eat you in a way that you know, they kind of eat into your bones in a way that other forms don't. They take a great deal, they ask a great deal, of something bodily, actually, when you work with them. At least that's what I've found. But and I was thinking about this particularly in connection with someone like Mansfield, who, of course, lived a short life and wrote those glorious stories, because the story itself has to be, it relies on being, it must be in the form, a moment of immense life, kind of the moment at which a kind of spatial form of life just opens like this and is completely held and brief, and you know that it's brief, and that's why it's alive. And so the connection between the aliveness of the story and the brevity of the form, more and more and more, seems to me to be something to do with the specialness of the form. And I've been wondering all these years as well why people, on the whole, so we're told, don't like short stories. You know, I'm told repeatedly all the time by publishers, really, and sometimes by readers, that they prefer to be lost in the form of the novel. I think that's what happens. You're lost in the form of the novel, the form of the story. There's no escape, actually, because that's what it is. You know it's going to start. You know it'll be over really fast. You know that it'll have delivered something, if it's a really good story, that will be completely beautiful and alive, but that will be held in this brevity. So it seems to me that the moment of that and the force of it are all connected to our knowing of, our understanding of consequence and mortality. And when I was reading these stories of Sparks, you know, in her novels, you don't get that sense in the same way. In the novels, she's rather like Hitchcock. She wants you to think. She'll tell you who did it right straight away, so that you'll think, and so that we'll use our brains rather than feel or be worried about pathos. She gave a fantastic speech to the American Academy of Arts and Letters, where she said, "What's the point in going to see a play which makes you feel? Because you come home, salt tears have rolled down your cheeks. You've kind of had your catharsis. You've had a really good dinner, but nothing's happened to your mind," she said. And in her novels, that really does happen. There's a mechanism in the novels which is about something else happens in the stories, which is really about the closeness of life, the feeling of the brevity of it, the way, and that's why it seems to me that she's able to let free her notions of the supernatural in the short stories in a way that she doesn't in the novels. Yeah? That do. Yeah. Okay. Lady here.
Same question.
Has anyone got another question about the short story Immortality? Yes, go at the front.
It's just a very simplistic question. What did you feel the two Johnnies were saying?
What did I feel they were saying? One was saying, "Happy Christmas." The other was saying, "I hate Christmas." I think in that story, it's a little gem of spark where she's saying exactly like she says in the beginning of Girls of Slender Means, "What's the point of being depressed about the Grand Canyon?" She's freeing us from politics. She's freeing us from history, and she's pointing out that we're held by those cycles, which are ritual, Christmas, which are, you know, or the falling of the leaves, which are seasonal. And there's no point in complaining about it. And, you know, to some extent, there's not really a point in celebrating it. There must be something else to think about. And perhaps it's to look at the split self, which comes when we try and, you know, sort out the feelings that, you know, that happen to us over time. So it's a story that's really about time, history, politics, and the endless leaves. And there's a deep, I think there's a deep kind of against surreality and existentialism in Spark. And in a way, that early story, she's working up to understand what to do with her existential, because she's also a Catholic, and to be a Catholic existentialist, I mean, it's one of those unitings of opposites. You know, you there's the system, so you play around with the system, which I think what she's very, very good at. Yes.
Sparks is, her arguably most famous work was The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
Yes.
And you sort of talked about this earlier, but how would you compare that book itself to her shorter stories?
Okay. To her short stories. Again, with Jean Brodie. In fact, Who here has read Jean Brodie? Who here has seen the film? Okay, it's kind of the same number of people. What's interesting about the film, I'm back to talking about Catholicism again, the film strips out any religious element from its adaptation of the novel, and the novel is really about fixed religions and the fixedness of response, and it's and also at the same time a transfiguration which comes through an understanding of the everyday. But the main character in it, Sandy, writes a treatise when she becomes a nun after the experience of Jean Brodie called The Transfiguration of the Commonplace, and there's a kind of an understanding of the romantic and the religious held in both hands like this in a kind of weighing balance in The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which, exactly like I was describing about the Hitchcock moment, if you remember, there's a description of Mary, the poor kind of lumpen character in the Brodie Girls, running hither and thither in a hotel fire, and this is how she dies, and we get this very early on in the book. So we know that Mary's doomed. That's it. We know really early on, and it's terrible that Mary's doomed, but we know it. So we move on to the rest of the book. With the stories, something unsettling is never answered. Something about structure with Spark stories, so the unsettling thing that happens is freed up into something beyond the form, in a way that with the novel, the novels are so tightly held in the kind of matrix of the form that it seems to me that in the stories, it's like, almost like she gives herself away. It's almost like she's dealing herself out. She's going, this is exactly what I'm made of. And that to me was exciting to see in the story form, like a liberating of Spark's own take on this world, the other world, and the way that she puts them together in right the way through all her work, I think.
Hi, could you say something about the collection?
Yes, it's a collection that has just come out, I'll say physically first. It's been brought out by Canongate. It's called one of their canons, the Canongate Canons. It's number two in their canon. It's a collection of all of Spark's short fiction and a couple of pieces which passed as fiction but which are also drama, dramatisations that she wrote for radio. It's not organised chronologically, which is an interesting experience. So you pass back and forth through time in the last 50 years of the 20th century in it, but it goes all the way up to her last story in the late, in the beginning of, I think it's 2000 actually, 1999-2000, the last story in here, and it gives us her very first, her earliest work as well. In that, it's a really extraordinary, electrifying read, because like I said when I was up at the podium, I actually couldn't put it down. And the experience of reading it, and reading through each of these stories, one after the other, many of which are ghost stories, not my favourite form, I have to say, was completely... in that way that I was very glad I'd been asked to do this event, because I know that something in my brain has changed from the reading of these stories and has been broadened and expanded and has remembered the importance of language, precision, wildness, the ways that precision and wildness, when they come together, make something which, held in a book, you think you can hold in your hand, but as soon as you read them, oh my God, the whole sky has opened and anything is possible. Because with Spark, anything is possible, and that's what this collection reminded me of.
Thank you. I just wondered if you could say more about your affinity, your writing. You said at the beginning you had an affinity with Spark, and I'd love to hear about your... Well, I know it was in the introduction, right. But you... Well, if you don't agree, then say that too. But just something about your stories in relation to her stories.
Well, I feel lucky in being Scottish, because we grew up with those yoked opposites. And I also grew up a Catholic. I'm now a lapsed agnostic, I suppose I'd describe myself. And so for me, Spark was a rare thing, a Catholic writer in Scotland. This is quite rare. There is a seam of Catholic writers in Scotland, and they really are a kind of bright seam somewhere in the Presbyteria, you know, kind of down here, still going on about art and pictures and music, you know. Art, pictures, music, art. That's kind of coming through the century as we come into what we can now see as the second kind of 20th century Renaissance, which was in the 70s and 80s, when writers like Liz Lockhead and James Kelman and Alistair Gray and then Janice Galloway and Alison Kennedy transformed the possibilities in fiction in Scotland. You can find the germ of that transformation in anything you pick up from Spark, because anything, any voice, was possible. Spark's the person who, I don't know if you've read her first novel, The Comforters. That's the novel which, at the time of all the angry young men kitchen sink dramas, you know, where it was all John Brain and Room at the Top and L-Shaped Room was later. But there was a realism, a tradition of realism. Spark, in her first novel, almost immediately announces that everything in this novel is fictional and none of the characters are real people or related to real people in any way. They're fictional. And then the girl in the novel starts to hear a voice while she's, you know, so Caroline was sitting at the table. Here's a voice typing, Caroline was sitting at the table. And then a split happens, which is between the notion of a god, the notion of a character, the notions of fiction, the notions of reality. Spark is really unusual in her doing this in 1950, I think it was 1957, pushing the form, allowing things to be utterly different, utterly other than everything else was in the art of the time, and at the same time asking those philosophical questions very, very lightly. This is what's extraordinary about Spark, very lightly held, very profoundly rooted questions. I like to think I'm connected to all those things that taproot of lightness, if you like. I like to think that I've got one foot in it. I hope I have. I hope all my reading of Spark has rubbed off on me, because her means of dealing with how we live with such a merriness, with such a kind of philosophical cock of the head, cock of the hat, I think is a kind of beauty, and it's a kind of medieval beauty, rather like she was describing those people. There's a kind of attention and objectivity in it both, I'm glad, rather like I'm glad I lived in the century where I was able to see Judy Garland sing the trolley song and Meet Me in St. Louis. I'm glad I lived to read Spark, because I think that she's like a linchpin of all the possibilities that come out in writers like Kelman, who's deeply realist and deeply experimental, or Gray, who'll take a page and he'll put on the side of a page a short story, although there's a main page of narrative down here, a short story, another moment here, you know, that the margins are filled with voices, if you like. Spark's one of those people who allowed us to play with voices. That's the name of one of her collections, Voices at Play. She allowed us that sense of play. There's another great writer. Who here has read Christine Brooke Rose? Anyone? One person. Everybody in the room, go out and buy Life End Of by Christine Brooke Rose, which she wrote about 5 years ago. Oh my God, what a fantastic writer she is. A contemporary of Spark and a friend of Spark's. She went off to France and helped in a way. She wrote the English version of the Nouveau Roman, the very, very experimental novel that Rob Grier and Nathalie Sorot played with on France. And Christine Brooke Rose at one point actually makes this phrase. She says, "Let us play rather than let us pray." And that's the spark. That's where the point at which energy enters all the things which we thought were fixed. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. I also just wanted to say that you read the story so beautifully.
Oh, did I?
Really?
Thank goodness.
Thrilling. Thank you.
Oi. It wasn't me, it was Spark. I tell you, when I met Janice Galloway in the kitchen before we came in, she said, we're channeling Spark. And I said, we are channeling Spark. So, you know, there's no escape. Ooh.
Well,
from the siren.
Absolutely perfect moment to bring this stimulating and enjoyable afternoon to a close. I'd like to thank Ali for so generously agreeing to read two stories from Muriel Spark, to talk her about her a little bit, at the very moment when her own
book has just appeared. It's very rare for an author to agree. It may be much better, but it's still very rare. And we really do appreciate that. I think all that Ali said about her affinity with Muriel Spock, which is what I mentioned at the beginning, all those things, if you really want to answer that question properly, then go and buy her new novel, There But For, and then you will discover it for yourself. Her, the way that Ali, and you can buy the Muriel Spock collection as well. Introduced by Janice, who probably won't be here anymore, but was a speaker in her previous event. And I think the other thing that they have in common is the way they subvert expectations. You never know what's going to happen next. So let's thank Ali and then buy her book and the collection and find out for yourselves. Thanks ever so much, Ali. Okay. I'm going to take Ali to the back now so that, you know, she can have a drink and settle down. If you can just wait 1 minute, and then come and get a drink yourselves.